Well, Nita will come to order. Representative Nornes, I see, has taken the step forward first. So, Representative Nornes, does somebody want to move House File 2602? Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Nornes, go ahead and present your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the committee. I was expecting to wait a little while, but I'm glad to go first, and this should be brief, I hope. And I understand there is one amendment, too, that needs to be dealt with. We could do that right away if you care, Mr. Chair.
Representative,
maybe first of all just explain this. This bill came to me at the request of a deputy who serves for the Otter Tail County Sheriff's Office, and he's the canine officer. And Minnesota has a statute that regards that regulates the use of the window tint or glazing on vehicles. And what this bill does is provides an exemption for police officers and their vehicles. Again, it was intended specifically for the canine, where the environment is pretty important, so the dog is safe, and for the heat is not a health factor. And so that's specifically what we're requesting, is that we simply exempt vehicles used by the sheriff's office or police department to be exempt from that statute.
Representative Nornes, I assume you want the A1 amendment to get in the shape you wanted. Is that correct, or
that would be correct? Yes.
Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, go ahead.
So the bill was originally drafted where it specified the transporting of a police dog, and it was kind of an afterthought that maybe that was too specific, and maybe we should leave the police the discretion of using tinted windows on any vehicle that they choose.
Okay.
So I think that's the reason for the amendment.
Are there any questions on this? Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, I formed this amendment, the A1 amendment, for the purpose of, I'm going to have a much further reaching window tinting bill later, and hopefully it will meet with the approval of the chair for hearing, but for now I wanted to match it up with that bill, and the number of different departments have come asking for an exemption, not only for police dogs, but for law enforcement in general safety, for a surveillance vehicle, for taking pictures or looking out, not wanting to see who the police are inside, or if you have a suspect or a witness. The witness inside the car can look out and ID somebody and not want the suspect to see who's in the back of the car. So it would be an exemption for law enforcement in for window tinting on the back and the side windows.
So, Representative Cornish, I'm not quite sure. Was that about this bill or about your bill, which is sometime coming?
Well, this is about this bill. Okay. Representative Nornes' bill only exempts for transporting a police dog, and this amendment would say police vehicles, so it would make for all police vehicles, not just for canine units.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nornes, is there anything else?
No, and I'm fine with that amendment.
Is there any other questions? Okay, then all in favor of this bill, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Oh, I'm sorry. The motion was to the general register.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's my question. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Representative Mason. Representative Mason, this is a bill that we already passed in this form last year, so we just forgot it when we scheduled the list of bills from last year, so this should be very short on testimony, since we've already heard the exact bill and passed it. Does somebody want to move them? So, Representative Kalin moves House File 635. Representative Nathan, go ahead.
I would like to pitch the staff further to the committee on commerce and
Oh, thank you. You did hear this last year. We have quite a bit of testimony. It's a basic consumer protection bill regarding cell phones and the fact that people should be given adequate information on their contract. And I'd like to move this to the Commerce, to the Committee on Commerce, and that would be the end of
testimony. Thank you, Representative Mason. I assume you want the A7, which just corrects the date, since it's not, didn't pass last year, it's going
to
pass.
What I'd like to do is we anticipate there may be some more additions to the bill when it goes back to Commerce, so I can handle everything at that point. We can do this if you like, but I know AALP wants to put an addition onto the bill as well, which they will probably do in Commerce.
Representative Mason, I just heard that it would slow it down, so we'll let you do it in Commerce.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to argue about the date change. Okay, is there any discussion on this bill? We discussed it last year before. Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
The motion is to move it to Commerce. All opposed, say nay.
No.
Carries. Thank you, President Mason. Next
thank
one.
Thank you, Chair members.
I don't see. Maybe we should do some of the others before. The controversial. Is Atkins here? Okay. Does somebody want to move Representative Atkins' 2719 bill? Thank you. Nobody wants
Chair, to Chairman, I'll move that, Your Honor.
Thank you. Representative Lilly moves 2719, and that one goes to Education Representative Chair Mariani's committee. Representative Atkins, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if you'd prefer to be called Your Honor, I'm happy to oblige. whatever works for you. I've been known to do that myself. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to be before the committee this afternoon. What this bill does very simply is it, just as it is inappropriate for a teacher or a principal or a coach to have a relationship with a 16 or 17 or 13-year-old child, it is just as inappropriate to have a sexual relationship with an 18-year-old. It doesn't apply outside of a school setting, a secondary school setting. If a 19-year-old and an 18-year-old or a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old want to have a relationship someplace other than a school, that's one thing. They're adults, but there is absolutely no reason, and it's inexcusable, for a teacher or a coach or someone in a position of authority at a school to have a relationship of a sexual nature with a student. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my witness this afternoon, is Dakota County Attorney Jim Baxter.
Mr. Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you, Representative Atkins, for taking this matter forward. This is an important bill. I thank you for hearing it. Last year in Hastings, so we had a tragic situation with a high school coach, assistant girls basketball coach, and also a boys baseball coach working with the school students in the Hastings School District developed a relationship with a senior girl. Actually, he had basically been pursuing a number of different relationships with phone calls, but there were literally hundreds of text messages and phone calls between this adult person in a position of authority over these students and these young women, and one of whom he ultimately had a relationship with, gave her alcohol, and also had a sexual relationship with her. The problem when it came to my desk for purposes of prosecution was that the young woman was 18 years old at the time the sexual contact occurred. Under current Minnesota law, that makes it not a felony, not a crime, for someone in a position of authority to have a sexual relationship with an 18-year-old high school student. We find that unconscionable for that type of behavior. Anyone who's in a position of authority who has sex with a student while they're still in high school should be held to a standard of strict liability. This is unacceptable behavior in our society. You may ask, we have to draw the line somewhere, because I've been asked this question. What about college students that have relationships with their professors? Mm-hmm. While I certainly don't condone those relationships, we have to draw the line somewhere. We draw the line in our law in many places. the line needs to be drawn for those students who are in a high school setting. And that's what this bill does, Mr. Chair and members. We believe this is a significant gap in our state's criminal sexual conduct that needs to be closed. The bill is very simple, as Representative Atkins indicated. It simply adds the position of authority issue to those, any a pupil in a secondary school setting, as that term is defined, with not graduated, not received a diploma, if they have a sexual, if someone in a position of authority manipulates that young person into a sexual relationship, it becomes a felony under Minnesota law. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Cole.
I think, Mr. Chair, and either Representative Atkins or County Attorney Backstrom, good bill. I mean, we should do this, but I guess the concern I have as I read the language here, I want to make sure that what the language is doing is actually what you're trying to do, Representative Atkins, because, and maybe this is a question for the county attorney, but as I read the underlined language here, does this mean that anybody who is in high school cannot consent? Help me understand the position of authority thing, because the language, maybe it's in the underlying statute, but the language here would seem to indicate that if I am 18 or 19 years old and still in high school, have not yet graduated, and I am the complainant, and a pupil in a secondary school, that this statute automatically applies to me. Can you talk to you about the position of authority, the teacher or coach issue, which I completely agree with you on?
Mr. Backstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'd be glad to answer that question for you. This law, the intent here is to do nothing different than what applies for 16 or 17-year-old high school students. The age of consent under Minnesota law is 16, to have sexual relationships with another person. But there are certain situations where consent is not an issue. And one of those is when someone is in a position of authority and has sexual contact with a 16 or 17-year-old high school student. That's the current law. That's the language that, although it's deleted on point 2.18, it's simply added back in on 2.20. It's just to make the statute word more appropriately. But if the complainant is at least 16 but less than 18 years of age, that's current law. The consent is not an issue if you're in a position of authority and you have a sexual relationship with that student while they're in school. And then the next language on 2.21 through 2.22 is simply to add the extension of that to any other student who has not, who is still in high school, who has not yet graduated, that has a sexual relationship with a teacher, coach, anyone who's in a position of authority.
Mr. Backstrom, I have a question.
Yes.
What is a position of authority? In other words, if you have one of these 4,000 pupil schools, and there's a person who taught them in seventh grade and hasn't seen them since, and it's a 20-year-old that's still in high school, is that covered or not? Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, a position of authority is a defined term under Minnesota law, under 609.341, subdivision 10. It's defined to include, but not be limited to, any person who is a parent or acting in the place of a parent or charged with any of the parent's rights, duties, and responsibilities to a child, or a person who is charged with any duty or responsibility for the health, welfare, or supervision of a child, either independently or through another, no matter how brief, at the time of the act. So it is a defined term under Minnesota law, and we would basically be referring to that in terms of what the word position of authority means.
What would be the answer to that, or what if the person was a engineer at the building or something?
Well, again, it would have to be someone that has in a position of authority that has contact with that student on an ongoing basis to exercise that. So it's like a teacher, it's like a coach, it's like someone, it's like a debate coach. It doesn't necessarily have to be within the school building. You know, it could be on the athletic field where they have a relationship, but it's a school employee, either a hired coach, a contracted coach, even a volunteer coach that is working for that school district that is in a position of authority over that student.
Over that student.
Yes.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions. along the line of what you're just speaking, where does it say the person in authority has to be associated with the school district? Could it be a boss at a place of employment? I mean, I read your definition of authority, but I didn't hear anything related to the authority's position being associated with the school. And I'm wondering how broad that is.
Mr. Baxter.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, the answer, I guess, under current law, you know, if you're in a position of authority as is defined by the statute, and you're and you have a sexual relationship with someone who is 16 to 17 right now, that is still, you know, regardless of where that position originated from, it's not applicable. So to answer your question, you know, I may stand corrected. It doesn't necessarily have to be connected to a school without some further definition. And
Mr. Chair, that's going to lead to my concern with the additional language. What you're trying to do, I think, is good, but you include in your definition of a secondary school alternative learning centers, et cetera, et cetera. You have 20, 21, 24, 25-year-olds that are attending alternative learning centers for English as a second language, maybe getting their GED, and with no top age in your definition on page 2, basically I think what you've done is, because authority is not defined related to the school, I think you're setting up a situation with this language where you could have a 21, 22-year-old going to an ALC and in a position of being able to bring suit against his or her boss at Burger King or IHOP. You know, I mean, so you've really opened up that window with no top age limit. You're not saying that the authority has to be associated with school, and by virtue of the fact that an individual is attending a school, they're going to have much greater ability to bring suit, and the person in authority outside of the school district might not even know that this individual is attending a school.
Okay. Mr. Baxter.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baxter.
Representative Holberg, that's actually a discussion that County Attorney Baxter and I have been having. I think that is our intention, was to sort of get a feel for where this committee was coming from with respect to that issue as well. And we originally had some language that kind of went along that line, that I think it had a top-out age of 20 because of the concern over that. But we need to make a stop here and then go to E12 as well, and we were thinking that we would take those into account, probably have language by the time we got to the E12 committee, because we share that concern as well. The other is the making certain that it's in the setting of the secondary school. I think we can come up with language that will accommodate that. I know that we're not going to the floor from here, Mr. Chair. I think we're going to make a stop in E12. And perhaps what we can do is try to address that issue before we get there, but also send it back to the members of this committee so you can kind of see what we try to do with respect to it.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if that's the case, I think that those are more policy issues for this committee than for the K-12 committee, because what the concern is for what happens in the outside world outside of the school. Certainly, I don't think anybody has any problem with people that are working within the school system, whatever their place may be or their position. But this concern relates not to the educational environment, but rather to how wide you open this window and people outside the school environment who would not even have a clue that a particular employee or person that they're working with in another venue might be attending a school somewhere, and no matter what their age, would subject them to this charge.
Mr. Representative Holberg, maybe I wasn't clear enough. I think what we're doing is we're going to try to do exactly what you suggested and put that into the bill before it gets to the next committee. We're not arguing with you. We just don't have that language, and rather than do it on the fly orally, it might be better off to try to do that language and certainly send it back to members of this committee, the chair and Representative Holberg in particular, and make sure that that is in fact what addressed the concern that you had.
Representative Atkins, I think there's quite a had a concern also about the broadness of your position of authority language in statute and applying to this extended situation. I think I know, and I've heard from that committee also, there's concern about that. A lot of concern about that. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Backstrom. You had stated in terms of what needs to be shown with respect to some ongoing relationship vis-a-vis the position of authority. Can you use an example of what needs to be shown for that ongoing relationship in a trial, for example, in order to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that this person is in a position of authority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, for example, we would look at the nature of the relationship between the two in terms of their work at the school. Is it a teacher? Is it a student-teacher relationship, which is a pretty clear position of authority? And we can ask a coach, as the instance in Hastings was, where there's a coach student-athlete relationship, where that student-athlete is taking direction from from that coach or assistant coach for a particular sport. So we would show that relationship exists in terms of a position of authority. Beyond that, we would not have to prove any additional elements in terms of the length of how long that position of authority was in existence. And the other thing that the law, and this was changed several years ago, and it applies now to 16 and 17-year-olds, it's a standard of strict liability. It's no longer a standard under the law where you have to show that you use your position of authority to induce or the student into a relationship with you. As long as you're in that position of authority over that student, you know, it's the law presumes that student is in a vulnerable situation and subject to influences from the person that they're dealing with. So, you know, that issue was changed several years ago in reference to, and it's a bill that I brought forth probably 10 years ago now. The legislature eliminated that aspect of this in relation to 16 and 17-year-old students. It was simply, this would apply the same thing to the 18-year-old.
Or Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Backstrom, for that follow-up. I would just say, for members of the committee, I think I have some concerns with this bill as I look through it, and I understand what it's intended to fix. What is perceived as a loophole of people being able to get out from under liability, criminal liability. I guess I never really looked at the age of majority as a loophole. It's a pretty hard and fast set age in our law for most things, and I see us as working to deplete that a lot in this and other committees. Obviously, I'm interested in looking at this more and see it, but I have similar concerns to Representative Holberg, what she stated, perhaps it's going to be solved in a different way, but I look forward to seeing it, as Representative Atkins said, that there are further stops for this bill.
Well, let me, and I might suggest, Mr. Sheriff, it's all right, if it would add some comfort level. We have language that we can offer. This is what happens when you have lawyers sitting at the table. We've got proposed language that would address those two issues, if it would, if the committee would see fit to offering the language. Mr. Chair, if it's all right.
Representative Atkins, go. What is it?
Well, the first is the position of authority and whether that might be at the Dairy Queen or something like that. So we, on line 2.19, it would simply add the following words. After position of authority, it would say within a school setting. Or perhaps better yet, within a secondary school setting. And the second would be on line 2.21. Representative Holberg raised a good point about in certain, like an alternative learning setting, you might have a 20 or 25-year-old, perhaps, or 24-year-old. We'd be comfortable with language that inserts after the word pupil, that would insert the following words, of 20 years of age or younger.
I'm not sure if Representative Lesh, do you have any more?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, I would just say, I think it's a fundamental difference in a position of a 20-year-old statutory rape charge. I can't conceive as supporting something like that just by nature of where we are. But I understand the author's position and direction, so let's agree to disagree.
Representative Kolf, just as a reference to committee, I'm wondering, I think the committee, Representative Atkins, thinks it's important to work it out in this committee, which is the primary. I'm almost wondering if we should lay this one over and try and work out something before we get into a long discussion today. And just what does the committee, I mean, I'll do whatever the committee thinks on that, but I just, the way things are going, we may be into a couple hours here and not work it out.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's I think everybody shares Representative Atkins' goal of trying to tighten this up, but Representative Atkins, I guess the concern I would have about the language you just proposed is I don't know that we want to get rid of the position of authority in the worst situation for somebody who's 16 and 17 years old right now, which I think your language might do. I think your school setting language, and I was talking with Representative Holberg, maybe gets close, and if we add that into the underline, but I think maybe if we lay this over, we can work on it and get out of here later this week or early next week.
I'm seeing a nod from Representative Tamer.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how many cases we'd have, but in discussion with staff, it appears that we may need a fiscal note on this also, Representative Atkins, so I don't... we should probably check that out.
I'll speak on that. And Representative Tamer, my understanding is there's going to be a fiscal note in K-12 committee too, I believe, so... I'm not sure why, but I'd heard something about that, so... I don't know where we're going on this.
So it would need to be referred to public safety finance at some point.
At some point, okay. What if people want to do, I would suggest we lay it on the table. That's okay with people.
Mr. Chair, okay. If I might just get some clarity, do you want us to try to figure out some language and present it yet back this afternoon, sometime yet in this setting? We just, obviously, we were up against deadlines with having to make a step in another committee and possibly a third committee. Just curious if there'd be some possibility that we might be able to figure out acceptable language so we can continue on in the committee process.
Representative Atkins, you could try that and bounce it around the committee while we're hearing other bills, or we would be able to probably get it on tomorrow morning also. I think we have our Thursday calendar, and I believe that it's not going to take the entire time. So, did anybody have comments, or Representative Kranz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the representative. I'm just curious where, youth associations not affiliated with the school would apply to this or not, because as maybe a youth coach not directly connected with the high school, whether it's during school calendar or not, in the summertime, there are kids, both boys and girls, at this age level that would be in a position with an authority figure. I'm curious where they might fit and if that can be addressed too. Thank you.
Well, we still have questioners. Is it okay to just lay it over? Or is it? Okay, then we'll lay this bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We'll do our best to try to figure out language that's acceptable yet this afternoon. If we can't, we'll find another time to come back.
Okay, thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins, I think you can stay there.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins, does anybody want to move the 2949? Representative Johnson moves 2949 to put it before the committee. Does this go to the floor? Or, it goes to finance, Representative Atkins. So the motion is to pass it and move it to the finance committee. Representative Atkins, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Salvia divinorum, maybe the single most potent hallucinogen that you've never heard of. It's actually been around for centuries, but just recently it's become the rage across high schools and college campuses as a recreational drug. Some argue that it's in the same category of LSD, far more potent than marijuana, and yet it's not regulated under Minnesota law. There's several states across the country that have started to ban this substance, listed as a Schedule 3 or 4 drug on their list. Because as you'll see, no less, I don't know how to list John Stossel here on your witness list from ABC News, but I was recently called attention to about, I don't know, 6-7 months ago, and I'll show you some of the effects of this drug. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Stossel. It's relatively brief, just a few minutes long, and I think you'll be impressed by the nature of what needs to be done here.
Mr. Stossel. Word salvia. We enter an underground world.
Is salvia. Do you like salvia Xanax? Take a look.
What you're seeing here is a new drug experience more and more young people are trying and sharing on the internet. It's called salvia divinorum, magic mint, Sally D. It packs a powerful hallucinogenic punch unlike anything else out there. And it's perfectly legal almost everywhere in this country.
But at higher doses, it produces a visionary state where you basically go into a waking dream. It's very similar to dreaming, like sleep dreaming, except that you're awake.
Oh, yeah, there is a feeling. Yeah,
okay.
All these videos are posted by people who claim they show people who are smoking salvia. They take a hit, and within a minute seem to get slammed by an intense psychological experience. They go limp. They lose coordination. They start to laugh uncontrollably. They call out incoherently. They cry. They just sit there, stunned. After just a few minutes, the trip ends. The kids are back.
I like to think that the trip is over now.
Experience is usually not pleasurable. It's usually kind of frightening and disorientating, and
it's scary.
It can be scary. I mean, some people are able to handle it better than others.
That's Daniel Siebert, one of the world's pharmacological experts on salvia. He's researched it, used it, and sold it over the internet for years.
And is this something that you would sell then?
Yeah.
How much would this cost?
Well, I sell this for $65.
Okay.
A gram of this.
It's an ordinary-looking herb, a member of the sage family, native to the mountains of Oaxaca, Mexico, where the Mazatec Indians used it for spiritual healing. Here, it's all about the trip.
I'm going to live.
But is it safe?
I think that he had smoked salvia to such an extent that something happened in his brain. I think he just snapped.
Kathleen Chittifer's 17-year-old son Brett killed himself in January 2006, zipping himself into a tent in his dad's garage in Wilmington, Delaware, lighting a charcoal grill and asphyxiating himself. According to his parents, he'd been smoking salvia on and off for months. His father, Dennis, found him.
And when I saw that tent in my garage, a light bulb went off. Something's wrong, you know. And when I saw tent in my garage, I tried to give him CPR, but with carbon monoxide poisoning, his living motor would set in. And if anybody knows, my brother was a respiratory therapist. I heard the death rattle. And so when I did the best I can. Unfortunately, the paramedics arrived within 5 minutes. I didn't have to suffer too long.
Brett was a straight-A high school senior. He had a job and a girlfriend. He was a together kid.
Well, I never saw any sign that there was anything wrong.
Brett's mom, Kathleen, the couple had been divorced since Brett was 3, believes her son's salvia trips were reshaping his mind, the way he saw himself and life and the world. He left behind a journal recording his new insights.
Our system of time has no meaning and is completely pointless in the grand scheme of things. Also, our existence in general is pointless when compared with everything else there is in the universe. Us earthly beings are nothing. The Brett that I knew and loved, he would never have said that. He would never have believed that.
Brett's parents are now speaking out, campaigning to have salvia outlawed, as it's been in Delaware. Brett's law, it's called. And so when the Chittifers see the YouTube video, they want to warn others.
Parents, a lot of them are oblivious. to what's going on. I mean, I didn't even know. You know, as close as I was to Fred, I didn't know what he was doing. But, you know, when I watch them, I think, really, wow, people really should be scared.
Had not some coming in would decide to commit suicide as a result of all the experience, but it just felt inconceivable to me. You know, I assume he must have had some other issues in his life.
Daniel Siebert argues that salvia, when used properly by responsible adults, can help deepen awareness.
You mentioned beneficial. This is a beneficial herb. How do you mean that? For whom? How?
It's beneficial as a tool for introspection, which I mentioned previously, and that's something that shouldn't be minimized. Sometimes I've taken salvia where I've had some difficult life situations, a relationship problem or something like that, where I was like, I'm saying, well, what should I do about this? And I've taken salvia, and suddenly, it's totally clear. It's like, why didn't I see this before?
Now, maybe that sounds a bit far out to you, a little trippy, but many medical researchers are excited about salvia because they say its unique properties hold tremendous promise.
As a doctor, as a clinical pharmacologist, are you concerned? Do you see how this drug operates? That there may be potential dangers? Or do you put it in a different category?
I think there are risks. I don't think we know what the risks are, but I wouldn't say the risk is zero. But I would not say the risk is large enough at this point to justify a major governmental reaction.
Dr. John Middleton studies drugs and drug abuse and his research in salvia.
So right now, this is perfectly legal for me to have this. I can walk out.
Yes, exactly.
Totally legal. It's unscheduled, uncontrolled.
Right now.
This week.
Right.
Next week, you can maybe go to jail for 30 or 40 years for holding that much
of maybe more.
What Mendelsohn and other researchers have found is that salvia vitamin is a rare substance that acts on a very specific part of the human brain, the kappa opioid receptor. That means drug companies could develop medicine to treat some mental illnesses, or cocaine addiction, or even more.
And there may be some derivatives that could be made that would actually be active against cancer. And HIV, there's some tantalizing evidence that kappa agonists actually prevent two HIV-infected cells from fusing with each other. This is big stuff. At the present time, there are a lot of therapeutic targets that have many people excited.
And it's worth exploring.
There's no question it's worth exploring. I think that you're seeing a lot of investment in that in the basic science world.
But all that investment, all that promise, could vanish overnight if the federal government criminalizes the sale or possession of salvia, as the Drug Enforcement Agency is considering doing right now.
I think it would scare away development, and could inhibit it.
But what about all those young people tripping on salvia? Should the government try to stop this?
If it has benefits to people, then we're all for that. I mean, definitely, but to just have it used randomly here and there by kids of all, that was 16 when he purchased it, and had no idea the ramifications. I mean, there was no warnings, there was no nothing. And to have it out there and readily available to kids of that age or even younger, I'm just totally against that.
Representative Atkins, that looks like legislators on the House floor after 80 amendments.
You don't need a prescription for that either.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Atkins, what's the effect of putting this drug on Schedule 4? What exactly are we saying when we do that from a civil or even from a criminal perspective?
Representative Atkins. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative De La Forest. And I don't practice criminal law, but as I understand it, there's still the ability to all these items under Schedule 4. If they have legitimate bases for use in the medical community and so forth, they're still available in that fashion within that context. But right now, they're randomly, widely, without supervision, available to anybody that wants to. In fact, I was told down by the pages that you can buy this stuff at Maharaja's down the street from us without any doctor's note, without any prescription, no limitations whatsoever. So that's what we're trying to get at.
Right. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, as you know, we've got this continuum of making substances unavailable, like, for example, saying you just have to be 18 to buy it, all the way to a heavy Schedule 4, where I assume you need a medical expert's prescription to get it. And I'm just wondering if this is the appropriate place to get it. I imagine the penalty, or to put it rather, are pretty heavy for violating a Schedule 4 prohibition. And this one is... Is there any other... I guess what I'm trying to say, colleagues, is it would help me at least if we had some type of expert testimony from a healthcare professional or a pharmacologist and the like saying that the properties of this particular drug are similar to phenobarbital and the like. Most of these drugs, I admit, don't mean a thing to me as I read them, but I do pick out a couple of them, and they're pretty powerful. That's my struggle. I don't know if anybody else is struggling with that or not, but... As I said, I imagine you'd go to jail for a while if you violate this, and I just don't know if the addictive properties and the like and the problem with this match up with putting it in Schedule 4.
Any further discussion? Representative Washington.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I do practice criminal law, but not drug crimes, although having looked through it enough in order to deal with some of the minor drug crimes I've done, those items include not just the what we understand as pure drugs, but also the isomers and salts of isomers and all everything down the list, so that when you tweak the chemistry a little bit, you got suddenly a legal drug again. Well, we now have statutes written up such that you can't do that. Is there any consideration for that in just including salvia divinorum on this? And what other derivatives there may be of it when we just include these three words in the statute, that they're not just going to tweak it and come up with the next party drug.
Representative Atkins. Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, this is, believe it or not, this, I appreciate the comment. This is one of those proposals that, believe it or not, I came up with on my own. So I don't have a battery of lobbyists or medical experts. I know it's kind of an unusual animal. To have something come up like that. But it struck me when I saw that story and then did some independent research and asked around about it that I didn't want young people or anybody else driving a car in that state or operating machinery in that state or just having that sort of thing available. So I would certainly welcome that that language. It's something that my doing my able best to come up with something that addresses it, but I'd certainly welcome that as a friendly bit of language.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I'm not prepared to do that yet, but I certainly can take a look at it. Thanks.
I appreciate that.
Representative Weber.
Representative Homer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of the other substances here able to be part of your landscaping?
Mr. Chair, Representative Homer, I don't quite understand what.
Well, in your written testimony, it talked about that this was a common at landscape and gardening shows.
All right.
And I'm looking at these chemicals, and I don't know if any. I mean, I don't know if it even can be grown in Minnesota, but there's like probably zero to no awareness of this. We don't want to make criminals out of little old ladies that think a plant is cute.
Chair Representative Holberg, I thought you meant landscape and sort of the virtual sense. You're talking about the garden, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what any of these things are that all have long names that even if I was a good speller, I couldn't spell.
No.
So, I mean, I'm just wondering, is it appropriate to put something that's a plant in with all these chemicals? And, I mean, does it grow in Minnesota? Will we see it here in our little old ladies' gardens?
My
or?
Understanding is that our climate does not accommodate growth of this, but
okay.
That's not to say that somebody in a greenhouse might not try it, I suppose, but it is naturally occurring in climates like Uruguay's, which are more in the equatorial neighborhoods than Minnesota's climate.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins or staff, I think it's back to kind of what Representative De La Forest is getting at. If I go and buy phenobarbital, I can't even say it, let alone spell it, Representative Holbrook, from Johnny in the dorm down the hall from me, what are the criminal implications of that as a Schedule 4 drug as opposed to getting it from a medical provider, because I think that's kind of the issue for this committee and potentially Representative Paymar's committee. What are the criminal implications of
this being being
felony.
Scheduled.
It's a felony.
Yeah. Well, Representative Tamer, you might get another bill. I didn't see the summary.
And to that point, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, I did look at Chapter 152, and you go to jail for up to 30 years for violating that chapter. And so, again, you know, my concern would be, as we have frequent discussions in this committee about how we allocate scarce law enforcement resources in conjunction with Representative Tamar's committee. And we had serious discussions about who gets the jail space, which, of course, always needs to be paid for and is scarce. And at least my thought would be I'd certainly feel more comfortable with some type of scientific and evidence from law enforcement as well about how serious the problem is, exactly how addictive and dangerous this drug is, before we start saying to the public, you may go to jail for 30 years and face up to $1 million fine for possession.
I kind of like Representative Atkins' bill, but that doesn't solve the finance problem that we
currently
have. This kind of scares the hell out of me, but we still got to...
That's a different issue, though, for this committee, but Representative Galen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but with Judge Dean here from who sits on the bench in Isani County on a different issue, I'm just reminded of the fact that two-thirds of the... inmate population in East Central Minnesota are nonviolent drug offenders that are on essentially technical violations. This salvia divinorum may indeed be the next mess. We don't know, and I think that I applaud you, for Representative Atkins, for raising the issue. And I just think that I just want to chime in about the collateral consequences that all five of our counties are building new jails in East Central Minnesota because of nonviolent drug offenses. And so I think if we look at the not only the collateral issues here, but just raising the point that I would like to see us talk about long term, which is how we actually treat nonviolent drug offenders and these offenses, I just think that maybe a little bit more testimony to be able to address some of these concerns. And, you know, I don't want our jail to be crowded before we even break ground next month in Chicago.
Representative Atkins, so they don't bring any more of these really simple bills.
Well, and to me, it remains as simple as if this drug is as potent as has been reported as LSD, and more potent, frankly, than marijuana, then it ought to be on a schedule somewhere. Whether it's appropriately on Schedule 4, perhaps it's better on Schedule 5, which I'm also fine with. But the fact is it ought to be somewhere. And I recognize that there could be potential financial consequences, and I expect that we'll do those in front of Chairman Tamar's committee. If this committee would feel better that it's along Schedule 5, but the point is if it's in the same potency, it has the same impact as something that is currently illegal, that has that kind of impact, be it LSD or worse than thought, then should it not be on this list? Simple question.
We're going to have to move on this and take... a vote, I think. We've got a lot left. I think there's quite a bit of concern. But all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
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 Carries, and it goes to Representative Pimar's committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. It goes to Finance, which sends it by letter to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastman, can you do yours in about 5 minutes or less? I know you've got a judge here, so I don't know how you can stop him from talking, but... Especially a judge that grew up in North Minneapolis. I don't know how we can ever stop him. Representative Eastland... I'll move House File 2820 and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to speak much at all. I'm going to leave that to Judge Dean. But I just briefly want to say that House File 2820 was before, I think, this committee last year as well, and we did pass it out of here. And I would just make one comment. This bill keeps drunk drivers off the road. That's what it does, and it has a tremendous potential payback to the state if we move in this direction. So I'm going to turn my testimony over to Judge Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is, in essence, the same bill that was brought last year. We have some new information, though. Utilizing the tracking program that I started 10 and a half years ago, which was tracking every DWI plea that came before me,
over the last 10.5 years. Folks have asked, has your safe cab been effective? We know you've given rides to, in 2 years, over 1,200 people and over 700 rides, but is it really working? Well, using that database that I just mentioned, we had a statistician, Rob Widener, who's a professor up at UMD, run that, and in fact it is working. For the bars that regularly use the safe cab in Isani County, we have reduced the DUIs from those bars by 65%. One of the bars alone has had their DUIs reduced by 83%. Do you think that's significant? We think it's saving lives, and that's why we're back.
Thank you. And I think that's probably enough testimony. Is there any questions? Okay. Representative
Gillen. Judge Dean and I have a little song and dance we like to do. Judge Dean, what does 772 mean to you?
Well, last year I didn't know, but this year I do know. It's the average number of times, according to the National Highway Safety Administration, that an individual drives impaired before he stops for drunk driving. 772 times.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alan, is there any discussion of this? We passed it last year. It goes to finance. The motion, my motion is renewed to pass it and goes to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed no. Carries.
Thank you.
Representative Hosh, do you have, are your witnesses from out of town?
They're from
Metropolitan. Oh, okay. Well, we've had this one on a couple times. Representative Hosh, why don't we take you then? Yes. We'll try not to bring you back three times. Representative Hosh, does somebody want to move Representative Hosh's bill? Representative Hilstrom moves 1625. Go ahead, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. There is a DE3 amendment.
Representative Hilstrom, I assume, moves the DE3 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants.
Okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Go ahead, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This was a bill in front of the committee last year in which a constituent of mine that brought upon this bill testified in front of the committee. If you don't remember or if you were not at that committee meeting, her written testimony is also provided to all the members. We'll go through this bill and exactly everything that this does. I am just going to be quiet myself and let the experts deal with it. With me is Liz Richards, who is from the Coalition for Bad Women.
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards. I'm Director of Advocacy at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm also a licensed attorney. The Order of Protection statute was enacted almost 30 years ago, and the Order of Protection is a critical tool for battered women to ensure their safety. Every year, the coalition is approached by a few women who need some longer-term protection than what's available under the order. And the written testimony, the testimony from last year, is one case example of that. And that currently what those women must do is they must go back to court every year, ask for an extension of their order for protection, go back to that same legal process. And that keeps a certain level of engagement going on between an abuser and the battered woman, going back through the process year after year. It also exacts quite an emotional as well as financial and psychological toll. So we're in support of the House File 1625 with its amendments, and because we believe it strengthens those protections. I'm going to highlight what those changes are and then just get open for questions if anyone has them. The first change adds language that the court can that specifically authorizes the court to issue no contact. Currently, the order for protection law does not say the court can issue a no-contact order. It seems a little contrary. But the court routinely issues it under the Supreme Court's uniform forms. There is specific language on those forms about no contact, but it's not specifically listed in the statute under the specific relief that the court can issue. And the court has been issuing no contact orders under a catch-all phrase that says the court may order other relief if it deems necessary for the safety of the petitioner. So this just puts that specific no contact language into the statute. The second change, it increases the standard time period for an order for protection from 1 year to 2 years. Currently under the harassment restraining order statute, that's for a fixed, the standard time period is 2 years. This just brings the order for protection statute in, to be consistent with the harassment restraining order statute. We know that there are some jurisdictions and some judges who already tend to issue for 2 year orders, even though that's not the standard under the statute. It still leaves it under the judge's discretion to decide what's the appropriate time period, either shorter or longer. The third change that is being proposed is that for persistent sort of chronic abusers, the court has the option now to issue a long-term order for protection or harassment restraining order. Now, although we support the permanent order for protection and harassment restraining orders, there are some technical difficulties that arise out of the use of the term of permanent order for protection. And that's why we have talked about looking at a 50-year order for up to 50 years order for protection or up to 50 years harassment restraining order. And what the issue is that to get the order for protections into the state databases to get enforcement of those orders, one of the fields that has to be entered is what's the expiration date on an order. And while it is true that they can put into that expiration field non-expiring orders, there are also criminal no contact orders which may get entered as non-expiring orders that are actually do expire. So what that means is it would result in this confusion for somebody seeing the term non-expiring order doesn't necessarily tell them that it's a permanent order. It may be one of these criminal no contact orders that has an unspecified date. And so it would, in order to get a clear, consistent enforcement of these orders, we believe it would be better to have a specific time frame, and that's why we are supporting the language of orders up to 50 years. And I guess I'll just leave it at that. Those are the three major areas of change.
Representative Lash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My only question is, we heard this bill in my subcommittee a week ago last Friday, and so I'm wondering what the process is for that. I mean, we've already done the hearing, so are we just going to have double hearings on this, or what?
Representative Lash, yeah, I checked into that. We have to have a hearing at this level now. It can be a shorter hearing than
normal. I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, because I don't want to have to put
you
the
report
into it
on
time,
what your committee did.
I'm sorry?
You want to report on what your committee did with it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think that, the committee passed it over to here. Nonetheless, I wanted to ensure that time wasn't being wasted at any level. That was my question.
Oh,
and, sir? Obviously the people who were here able to speak to it.
Representative.
Well, I think the other issue, Representative Lash, is that the DE3 amendment, which we're dealing with now, is fairly, there's some significant changes from the time that you heard it.
Okay, thank you.
It's considerably different. I thought you were saying that you'd heard the DE3. Is there Representative Hosh?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I appreciate the time. I urge support of House File 1625 as amended. It modernizes Statute 518B. Also, this takes the solves the lead of several other states before us that do have indeterminate or permanent protection orders, including the states of New Jersey, Alaska, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, New Mexico, New York, and Washington. And with that said, I will just give up my time to the committee.
Sure. Is there any one in the audience that wants to testify? Okay. Is there any questions or comments from anyone? Okay, then for Representative Westrum.
Chair, I guess the author, Representative Posh, would this cover, when you say no contact order, does it cover both ways? So if the contact, no contact order or the restraining order is on the, maybe the ex-wife against the ex-husband or vice versa. And what I'm asking, the reason I'm asking this is I've talked to different judges along the way, and one of the things they've told me that is they see over and over in their courtrooms is restraining orders only go one way, and so the other party is not in violation if they call up subject A, calls up subject B, who subject B has a restraining order. They're not in violation, but if subject B contacted subject A, they would be in violation. And their opinion, and it makes sense to me, is if the restraining order is against subject B contacting subject A, it seems to me it should just go both ways so there's no threat and chance that one party gets, for whatever reason, calls up subject B and then potentially there's a violation of a restraining order or a harassment order. And so is this change going to cover that, or would you be open to an amendment that we would clarify that so we would straighten out that situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe Ms. Richards could answer this, and I think Representative Payman also is fighting at this.
Representative
Payman? Yeah, Ms. Richards can probably do a better job, and I just would say that I think that would be, I would hope that you would not offer that amendment, Representative Westrum. Two things, I mean, what is in this bill and what's in the amendment deals with the respondent and not the petitioner in an order for protection. So the onus is on the respondent to follow the order, and it would make it a nightmare, I think, for law enforcement if they had to act sort of like a judge and jury at the time of considering who's actually in violation here. The order is against the respondent. They're responsible. Law enforcement goes. They have a copy of the order, whether it's a no-contact order or an order for protection, and they know who the respondent is. And I think that would just be opening up a huge can of worms. And it's not that I don't understand, you know, that there has been some frustration over a petitioner calling a respondent, but to make them both equally responsible for the respondent's violation, I think would be incorrect public policy, and we shouldn't go there. That would be my Ms. Richards, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Chairman, Representative, one additional thing. I mean, if there are issues, there's nothing in the current law that says if somebody, whether they're if there are respondents already in one of these orders, if they believe that they're being contacted in a way that is harassment, they can certainly file a petition and get, you know, does that include them once they're respondent in some one of these orders, and then if there's sufficient basis to file and say, I don't want contact from the other party, probably would be filing a harassment restraining order that would also then prohibit contact if the facts warrant it. But those situations can be addressed through the current law the way it exists. But the remedies flow from the petitioner. Petitioner seeks no contact, and the relief is would prohibit the respondent right now from having contact unless the facts warrant the respondent filing their own action. I mean, and it is a fairly major change that you would be proposing to the very scheme of how the order of protection is set up.
Okay. Seeing no further, the Hillstrom renews her motion to pass as it's amended and refer it to Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Bigham. Representative Bigham moves House File 3102. This is Finance. And it goes to Finance. Representative Bigham, go ahead and present your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A person can be found guilty and sentenced to first-degree murder if that person causes death while committing child or domestic abuse. House File 3102 eliminates the pattern requirement or element and inserts the previous incident element of abuse. The bill also goes ahead and defines what those previous incidents of child abuse and domestic abuse are. I have two testifiers this afternoon, my good friend, County Attorney Baxham, and a representative from the Battered Women's Coalition. So I'll turn it over at this time to Mr. Baxham.
Mr. Baxham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Representative Bigham, thank you for bringing this matter forward. The impetus of this bill came out of a ruling from the Minnesota Supreme Court late last year. A case that came out of Dakota County, a case that involved a brutal homicide by a man by the name of Johnny Clark, who killed his longtime girlfriend and partner, a woman he had been abusing for years. The jury in this particular case convicted him, found beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an existence of five prior incidents of domestic abuse that led to a past pattern, as the current law applies, going back, some of which were 13, two of which were 13 to 15 years earlier. The Minnesota Supreme Court, in its interpretation, overturned the decision of the jury, substituted its judgment for the jury, and concluded that the 13 to 15 year old incidents of domestic violence involving these same two individuals were too remote in time to be considered to be part of a pattern. And they also ruled that because the one of the earlier, more recent incidents, two of which included the defendant kicking the victim while she was on the floor, another involved the defendant pulling out a gun during an argument to intimidate the victim within a year or so before this homicide took place, the court ruled that those acts had not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt to be part of a pattern of domestic violence, and substituted some additional requirements that are not in the law, saying that we have to prove that it's now a regular way of action for a defendant before we can convict someone of a first-degree murder involving domestic violence. Mr. Chair, committee members, it is my belief and the belief of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which has also endorsed this proposal, that ruling by our Supreme Court puts significant restrictions on our current law and our ability to show and use this statute as it was intended to be used by this legislature when it was enacted. The purpose of redefining the language here is to make it very clear as to the fact that prior incidents of abuse between the parties to this situation that ultimately results in a homicide can be used if we can show two or more acts of that abuse occurring at any time prior to the death of the victim, and we can prove that by direct or circumstantial evidence. I also forgot to mention that one of the other of the five issues the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled had not been proven because we used the circumstantial evidence to prove this. And as this committee well knows, and as the law is very clear on, direct and circumstantial evidence carry the same weight in a court of law, and yet our Supreme Court again substituted its judgment for the intent of this legislature. We believe in this important statute. This is a very important issue. Domestic violence is a huge, huge problem, not only in our state, but across America. And we believe that this ruling and the restrictions placed upon it will put prosecutors in a very difficult position of using this statute as it was intended by this legislature. And that's the purpose for of this proposal that Representative Bingham has put before you, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have, or you want to have the other witness testify first.
Maybe we should have the other witness testify.
Mr. Richard?
Yeah, and just very briefly, thank you, Chairman.
Professional witness.
Not really. MCDW is testifying in support of making changes to the first-degree murder statute and to respond to the Clark decision and to clearly clarify what that term past pattern of abuse means. There's a long legislative and court history of recognizing that murders arise out of a context and out of different situations, and that that context out of which the death arises makes a difference. Murder in the first degree was previously amended to create the first degree murder charge when murder rose out of a battering relationship. And that's what led to making it a first degree murder if there's a past pattern of domestic abuse. The legislature and the courts have recognized concepts of self-defense, and particularly battered women's self-defense concepts. There's nothing in the previous law, the law the way it stands right now, or in these amendments that changes those sort of concepts. We do recognize that the context out of which violence arises makes a difference, and it makes a difference in part to public safety, because it really impacts the public differently as well as the individuals. The first-degree murder statute reflects the legislator's intent to say that a murder committed on a victim who has been living with coercive control, with terror in a battering relationship, is more serious than a murder that is committed outside of the context of that type of relationship. And the Supreme Court in the Clark case issued a finding that basically ignored that battering relationship and that context. So while I must say that our membership has not come in support of any particular language to specific statutory language on this, we clearly are supportive of Dakota County Attorney's Office and Representative Bingham in looking at finding a way to respond to the Clark case and to clearly define this context, the past pattern of abuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can answer questions if there are any.
Are there any questions or comments on this? Okay, it looks like everybody's ready to vote.
Mr. Chair, actually, my motion.
Representative Bingham renews her motion to pass it and refer it to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
Can I do my best to get this? The guy has been sitting out here for all of the time. I do.
You want
to? Mine will just take 5 minutes. I've got to been a testifier.
Representative Thamer, you can do it in 5 minutes?
Yep.
Don't challenge people. Representative Tamar moves House File 2877. If you know, if you told me that was your witness, I would have continued. Representative Tamar, do you want to describe it, or Mr. Gillespie?
I'll just briefly say. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2877 repeals the current defense of disarming a peace officer, which is part of the obstructing legal process, arrest, or fighting or firefighting statute. And real briefly, in 2005, there were 230 Minnesota police officers who were assaulted in the line of duty, A recent study showed that 21% of the attacks involving an attempt to disarm the officer, 5% of the time the assailant gained control of the officer's weapon, and 30% of those events the officer failed to survive. A final study suggests that an average of 8% of police officers killed in the line of duty are disarmed and murdered with their own weaponry. So this, what we're trying to do here, is we're repealing this we're adding the language that expands the beyond a dangerous weapon, so there's other equipment that law enforcement also uses, and so if an individual is trying to take that away from the officer, that would also be considered a felony. I have with me Bill Gillespie, who is with the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, that can expand more and answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chairman, again, my name is Bill Gillespie. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We represent about 8,000 police officers across the state of Minnesota. This is an expression of the resolution that was brought to the convention in regards to the growing use, the growing instances where officers are being attacked, they're losing control of their defensive weapons. And frankly, over the years, we've hung more and more defensive weapons on police officers' belts. We now have tasers, we have electronic disabling agents, chemically disabling agents, and batons, asps. There are all sorts of weaponry that we have, defensive in nature, on the belt. Unfortunately, when it is used against an officer, the next thing that happens is they get a hold of the officer's gun, and in that situation, the officer fails to survive 30% of the time, as Representative Tamar indicated. We are willing to presently sacrifice the disarming of the police officer language that exists in the statute, because frankly, they're not necessarily going for the weapon. And if they get a hold of your taser, if they get a hold of your chemically disabling agent, you're going to lose your firearm. And secondly, also more importantly, as folks come on to the police department who are not necessarily 6'6" and 270 pounds, but in fact smaller, they're running into adversaries who are able to physically take advantage of them. And so we have to take that fact into notice, and we need to protect in a special way because of the special relationship that the legislature has with its law enforcement officers, because we carry out the duties that you assign us and we enforce the laws that you create. This legislature, we feel, has a special obligation to protect law enforcement.
Okay, is there any questions or comments? Okay, it looks like Representative Tamar renews his motion to...
I think this needs to go to finance first. Mr. Carter has... we don't think it's going to have much of a bad impact, but we're still gathering some information.
Well, Representative Tamar, that's where I was sending it. Representative Tamar renews his motion to pass this and re-refer it to finance committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Representative Atkins, you can try again in a short couple minutes, although I don't think that that solves the issue.
Well, you just
at least for me it doesn't.
Mr. Chair, we have an amendment that addresses one of the issues, and then I'd like to discuss the second. The A2 amendment, if you'd be so kind.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have to take the bill off the table formally. Okay. So now, go ahead, Representative Atkins.
That's House File 2719, Mr. Chair. If you'd be kind enough to offer that on my behalf, I'd appreciate it. That deals with the issue that Representative Hallberg raised about you may encounter some students who are older in an alternative setting. It's capped at 20 years of age, and it also makes sure that this is in a secondary school setting, not at the Dairy Queen or some other place, and I think it's being distributed to members right now.
Representative Atkins, the chair will move A2 to get it in the shape Representative Atkins wishes. All in favor say aye. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, go ahead,
Mr. Chair, I understand that there is an issue perhaps with some members about the position of authority and whether that applies to the custodian, perhaps the school cook. It's defined in the statute. Position of authority is a statutory term. We're perfectly comfortable living within that that context, and quite frankly, the statute reads, it's anybody that's responsible for the health, safety, welfare, supervision of a child. And if that happens to be the cook or custodian, then this ought to apply to them as well. They shouldn't be having any more relationship with an 18-year-old student than a teacher or a coach or anybody else. And I'd appreciate your support with the bill as drafted or as amended.
Well, Representative Atkins, I think a 20-year, doesn't this cover a 20-year student too? or under 20, 19-year-old, so could be an 18-year-old volunteer with a 19-year-old student would be covered.
Mr. Chair, if you had an 18 or 19-year-old volunteer, an 18, 19-year-old coach, whatever position they're holding, if they're in a position where they affect the health, safety, welfare, supervision of that 18-year-old student, they should not be having a sexual relationship with that student. And I will not weaken that. If that is what causes the committee not to like the bill, then so be it. But I don't intend to weaken that language any further.
Is there any discussion of this bill? Okay, then all in favor. Oh, wait. Where does it go? Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. This one goes to Carlos. Who made the motion?
B12.
No, I know. I'm trying to. We're trying to recall who made the motion about an hour and a half ago. Was it Representative Johnson? Okay, Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass this and refer it to the E12 Policy Committee. As amended. All in favor, say aye.
Excuse me, sir. This was mine, I believe. I called you honor and all that stuff, so.
Yeah, that's true.
But I don't want to slip the vote. I could,
okay.
I'll say aye. But,
so, Representative Lilly, we want to never slight you. Representative Lilly renews his motion to pass the bill and re-refer it to the E12 Policy Committee and the bill as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carry.
Mr. Chair, members. And thank you, Representative Lilly, in particular.
Thank you, Your Honor, too.
Then, Representative Olin moves the minutes of the February 19th meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Meeting is adjourned.